You're listening to Stand Out with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Stand Out with myself, Ian O'Connell, is Daniel Foyles. Daniel is an award-winning Irish wildlife photographer and marine and freshwater biologist. He has won the Irish Ocean Biodiversity Photographer of the Year, and he is now living the dream doing what he loves over in Vancouver in Canada. Sit back and enjoy the show. Daniel, I'm delighted to have you on the show today for a chat. We've been chatting for a while now, and I love the work you do, so I'm delighted to have you on. How's life with you?
Excellent, Ian. Now, I have to say I'm enjoying life at the moment. I've just moved over to Vancouver, and I'm here now almost a month, and yeah, it was a fairly, I won't say last minute thing, but I only came over to visit a friend in September, and I was only here a few days when I thought, you know what, this place really suits me. So yeah, I have to say, you know, I'm absolutely loving it at the moment.
I like to ask my guests at the start, Daniel, I suppose, growing up, do you want to bring me back just to paint a quick picture? Were you into sports, and did wildlife kind of photography come later on, or what was, I suppose, your childhood like?
Yeah, I mean, the photography, I only started in 2019. Growing up, I played pretty much every sport you can think of. Gaelic, hurling, rugby, swimming, gymnastics, you name it, I played it. And I did that up until, I was playing football until 2018 solidly. And then every now and again, I kind of go back and play a bit of junior here or there. And then hurling, I played until 2021. So everyone over here is mad to get me into a hurling team. But the photography only started in 2019. So I decided to do marine and freshwater biology in Galway. And when I was down there, I just got a camera kind of to mess around with, play with, and very quickly thought, you know what, I might be able to tie these two things together. So I did my college placement in South Africa for 2 months, and I brought camera gear down with me, and it took off. But before that, I had just got in with Dunsany Nature Reserve, which is 10 minutes from where I live in Meath. So Dunsany Nature Reserve is, it's one of the largest rewilding projects in Ireland. So it's basically an old country estate. And Randall, the guy who owns the place, he decided just over 10 years ago to let the place go back to wild. So I started going in there and basically kind of started taking pictures and photos, and couldn't believe the amount of wildlife that Ireland has. So very quickly, it kind of, my skill set grew as a photographer, when I suppose it's easy when you're surrounded by nothing but wildlife and nature. So the interest was always there, but it absolutely spiraled in 2020. But growing up, sport was a massive part of my life. It still is, and I'm definitely looking to get back into that. But I also had a love for nature as well. Growing up, I had, my grandfather was a farmer, so I was kind of surrounded by fields growing up. And then family holidays was almost always down to the west of Ireland. So that's where the love for the ocean came from, I think.
Would you have liked watching the kind of nature programs, David Attenborough, all them kind of things as well?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I grew up watching. Steve Irwin was a massive hero of mine. David Attenborough, I would have watched every show that came out. And then you have other amazing role models such as Steve Backshall, Ken O'Sullivan as well. Ken O'Sullivan is Irish. He's from Kerry originally, and pretty much everything you've seen underwater in Ireland, Ken has filmed it. And actually, I got to meet him there about 2 months ago, which was a nice kind of full circle moment. But I grew up watching all of those nature documentaries growing up.
How do you say that name? I think, was he on the 6 o'clock show going back a couple of weeks ago?
He was indeed, yeah.
Didn't he? When you said the name there, kind of rang a bell. Like he you'd have kind of looked up to his work, would you?
Oh, massively. He was an absolute role model growing up. I saw him the first time at the Irish Dive Expo down in Nenagh in Tipperary, and I kind of elbowed my friend. I was like, oh my God, that's Ken O'Sullivan. And then another friend of mine, Grace, she's working for the Irish Wildlife Trust, Grace Carr, she introduced me to him, and I met up with him. And again, it was like a full circle moment, and we just kind of chatted about all these things. And I just kind of came to realize how similar our paths are, in the sense that he started I suppose like any photographer or videographer started with a camera and it just grew from there. So it was nice chatting to somebody who has done so much for the ocean and for Irish seas over the years, and just getting to kind of chat to him and see basically what I can do with my work as well was amazing.
Because you think that there is kind of a misconception when people see the likes of your work or anybody that has been doing for a couple of years and the pictures are so kind of crisp and perfect. Do you think there's a misconception that when you start off, you have to get a really expensive camera and get the gear straight away?
Absolutely, there is a misconception. I am a massive advocate for secondhand camera gear. I started with a cheap camera. I think if you were to look at buying the camera, and I only got rid of it there about maybe 3 months ago, I would still use that. If you were to buy that secondhand now, you might be able to get for 150, 200. So this whole thing of going and buying a really expensive camera, it's like giving somebody who's never driven before an F1 car. You can only do what you know with that piece of equipment. So if you start out with a cheap camera, cheap gear, that's how you learn. So it's all about kind of learning the basics, and that's how I started. And then as you progress, then you can look for upgrading the gear, which I upgraded to some nicer gear now earlier on in the year, and it definitely makes a difference. But if you don't know how to use it initially, it won't be any good to you. So I'm all for start cheap and work from there.
And I suppose when you were kind of getting into it from college, did you enjoy the academic side of school as well, or was it always kind of out in the outdoors you'd have rather be?
I did. I enjoyed both. I think something that college teaches you is that it's not like secondary school where you have a lot of subjects you might enjoy. I mean, even like I'm a marine freshwater biologist, and I, to put it nicely, I didn't do great in biology in the leaving cert. And going into first year, I went to GMIT or ATU now, and going into first year doing biology was kind of dreading it a bit and thinking, is this going to be a struggle? But the fact that you're doing subjects and modules that you're genuinely interested in, it makes such a difference. So as much as I love the field work, the outdoor work, field trips, all of that, when you're actually learning about topics that you have a genuine interest in, it makes such a difference. So, I mean, first year of my course was general science, and then the marine biology and the freshwater side started in second year. But even in first year, it's much more enjoyable when you can see why you're learning these things, which obviously you should be able to see when you're doing these various different subjects in school, but it's kind of harder to see the end goal. So I absolutely loved college. And I mean, they do say every day is a learning day, but in college, it's even more kind of exaggerated, I suppose, because you're learning things that you wouldn't have even thought to ask about. And now suddenly you're learning about topics that are genuinely interesting.
And like you say, it's not like secondary school where you're doing different subjects that you might even like history or maths or something
Exactly, yeah.
you love. And like it does make it all that much easier knowing that you're going in every day to college doing something that you want to do, and you're not dreading what's the next double maths class or something like that.
Exactly, yeah. That's it exactly. I mean, you still have to do some of the basics when you're in first year, but even the likes of say maths, like I didn't do chemistry or physics for the leaving cert. And that was the big thing going into first year. I thought, oh God, what am I going to do now? I haven't any experience in this. And they teach it from the absolute basics, and they're generally very good at teaching those subjects. So going in and starting physics or chemistry for the first time, it is a bit daunting, but it's also enjoyable because a lot of people are at the same level you're at. So it's a different level of learning, I suppose.
Now, 2019, when it did really take off, like you said there, Daniel, was there a certain picture that you took that you said, right, this can become a lot more than a hobby and I have a future in this?
I think so, yeah. I know that the big one, so 2019 was kind of the learning process. I mean, I'm still learning things now, but 2019 was the absolute basics. And then I think it was early 2020, it was just before the start of COVID. I had a photo of a fox and a pheasant in a field, and the fox is just peeping its head out from a hedge, and this pheasant is just basically sitting in the last rays of light at sunrise or at sunset. And it's just a very simple photo of a fox looking at a pheasant. And I had just joined a Facebook group. I think it's called Ireland's Wild Birds and Animals, the brilliant group. And when I started, I think I had about 10,000 members. And now it's gone up to over 100,000 members on Facebook. And I remember putting that photo up and getting amazing feedback. And people were contacting me saying, this is such a lovely photo. And what happened next? And it just kind of, it really kind of nailed it down that I was like, okay, this is actually something that I'm really enjoying now, taking nice images. And that slowly led to, okay, what can I do with photography in relation to conservation? But initially, I think it was probably that photo of the fox and the pheasant that, even thinking about it now, it's still one of my favorite photos.
It's amazing, like how a simple photo of just a fox and a pheasant looking can blow up so much, isn't it?
That's it exactly, yeah.
I heard you talking on a kind of a Zoom call. It's up on YouTube at the moment. But when you're preparing for a shooter going out, what would be the kind of basics that you have to look out for? I heard you saying that you might be going to an animal that mightn't be so familiar with humans, so maybe you don't want to go too close and scare them away. What would be I suppose, the basics when you're heading out on a shoot that you would kind of look for, and that'd be the kind of essential things to do?
Well, the main thing that I always tell people is learn about what you're trying to photograph. A lot of animals and birds, they have different behaviors at different times of the day. So if I'm going out to try and photograph a cuckoo, which their numbers were massively depleted in Ireland, part of that is down to several reasons. One of the main ones is agriculture. So when you have, say, bogland that has been cleared and now it's just flat fields, the main two bird species that a cuckoo will look for their nest to lay their eggs in are the meadow pipit and the skylark, which rely on wild grass. So when you have farmland that is basically kind of pristine grazing grass, then you don't have those two birds. And then in relation to that, you also don't have the cuckoo, which at the time I didn't know any of this. I just thought, oh, well, surely I'll find a cuckoo in a hedgerow. And what I would encourage people to do is learn as much as you can before going out. That way, you know where to look, what time of day to look, what time of day they're most active. So, a lot of animals, wildlife, they're most active first thing in the morning when they wake up, and then just before they go to sleep in the evening. So, what I'll try and do is, I would say for woodpeckers, I absolutely love woodpeckers. I was filming them in Dunsany 2 or 3 years in a row. And they were extinct in Ireland. They only made a comeback in the early 2000s. So what I would do is I would look for suitable habitat. So old deciduous forests, so oak trees, birch trees, that kind of thing. And then I'd look for when they're most active. So that came in handy for Dunsany, where I would be looking in areas of the forest where I know, okay, these kind of trees, this is what they're going to nest in. And then I would be looking at what times of day they're most active. So when they have their chicks, they're most active during the middle of the day when they're constantly flying around looking for food to feed the chicks. So the first thing I would say is essentially to learn as much as you can about the subject that you're trying to photograph. And then after that, it's kind of a simple try and blend in. So try and wear dark colors, earth tones, greens, browns, even black, essentially. Most of the time I'm wearing a camo jacket, but even a green jacket, just something that you're not going to stand out. I mean, what I'm wearing right now would be quite bright colored. If I'm walking around the forest and I'm trying to stay hidden, you will never see me in reds or blues or even kind of bright green. It'll be try and be, I suppose, what you're wearing now, that hoodie, kind of a darker shade of green. So trying to blend in and know as much as you can about your subject. And after that, it usually comes hand in hand.
It is. It's amazing, like, to know the different natures of what the birds do at what different times and all of that. I wanted to ask you this actually. Did you realize how much nature there is in Ireland before you started doing this job?
No, not really. I mean, you hear stories of people having seen these animals over the years, or certain areas would have certain wildlife. What I didn't realize is that you can find wildlife anywhere. And one of my best, I suppose, pieces of advice that I give my friends here if they're hiking, if you sit still in a forest for 10 minutes and just stay silent, it's amazing the amount of wildlife that will just appear. So I knew Ireland had a lot of wildlife, but I thought it was kind of in certain areas, pockets of the country. And very quickly I came to realize there's a lot more. Even small species of bird I didn't even know were here. Small, kind of simple birds, nothing too exotic, but birds that most people wouldn't have even heard of, like a chiff-chaff or a willow warbler or a blackcap. These were all birds that I'd never even heard of until
There's
I took
so
up
many, like, isn't
photography.
there?
There's so many. There's so many. It's amazing to see. And some of these you can find in a garden or a hedge, but it's that I wasn't noticing them until I had the camera. And then when I took up the photography and suddenly I'm looking at anything that moves, and then I'd start seeing a bird. What's that? And then I'd have to go back and look it up in a bird identification book, or I'd look it up on Google, small bird, green wings, brown head, that kind of thing. And it was only when I got into photography that I started to notice things. And I think some of my friends have now, through me, started noticing other things, other species, other birds, animals, simply because they know that I'm looking for them and noticing them. And then they're also kind of thinking, oh, I wonder would Dan know what this is? So it's kind of a nice, I suppose, stepping stone for other people as well. By me noticing things and putting these up, other people are starting to notice them. But without photography, I wouldn't have noticed half of these.
Like you say, you always know if there is nature, but you probably didn't realize how much there actually was in different areas of the country. What do you think is the hardest, maybe not species, but animal to get a
Ooh.
good picture of?
I think there's two. I think the main ones are pine marten and red squirrel. And generally speaking, you can find them in the same areas. So grey squirrels, which were the most abundant squirrel, they, I suppose, took over red squirrel territories. And then when the pine marten started making a comeback, they will hunt and predate on grey squirrels. Red squirrels are smaller and lighter, so they can escape up to higher branches in the tree that a pine marten can't follow. So you'll see the two of them together. But the pine marten is mostly nocturnal. I've only seen them in person maybe twice. And
Really?
the time that I got photos of it was just before dark. And you see this flash of black running through the trees. And it kind of has a bounding action. It kind of hops along. And they're incredibly shy animals. They're not really, I suppose, comfortable around humans, where you might get an animal that will eventually, like say a rabbit or even grey squirrels, you'll see them in parks. Pine marten are very, very shy and elusive animals. They are very widespread at the moment, which is great that they've made a massive comeback, but for the most part, they're quite shy. And then the red squirrels, it's as simple as there are so few areas to support them that they're not being seen, and they're also quite elusive as well. So the first time I actually got really good photos of them was down in Wicklow, and seeing them after hearing about them for years. I mean, you grow up hearing about red squirrels and how they nearly went extinct, and then seeing a red squirrel in person just knocking about in a tree above you. It's, yeah, it was a really special moment seeing them. So the pine martens and the red squirrels would definitely be, I think, the two most elusive and hard to photograph animals, but you can still definitely find them.
Were you far into your, I suppose, career when you started doing drone work?
I was a good bit, yeah. My dad had a drone for years, and I was kind of, eventually I was allowed to have a go with it. And then I thought, you know what, why don't I get my own? And then I got one of them and I got the license, and I looked into, I suppose, everything that I needed to know, like legislation and that. But getting into the drone work now
Are they
was,
strict enough with that, Daniel? The kind of,
they are, yeah.
yeah.
So the main thing is, if you have a drone over a certain weight, so if it's a really small toy drone, you don't have to. But for the majority of drones, they're DJI drones. So I have a
Yeah.
DJI Mavic. So for those ones, the main thing is to have it registered with the IAA. And then if you're looking at doing any kind of work with the drone photography, videography, surveying, then you'll need to do a drone course, which it's an online course and there's a multiple choice quiz at the end. So it's very much doable. It's not a kind of exclusive thing that you have to have certain capabilities. Anyone can go on and do this course and take the quiz and get it. But getting into the drone work is absolutely, it's a completely different point of view. I mean, growing up seeing a wildlife film shot from the side of a helicopter, and now I can do it with a drone. Obviously, you have to be much more careful with a drone because it does create disturbance with noise. But for the most part, having a camera in the sky is it's a completely different type of photography. And I returned to South Africa last year and I had a drone last year. And that was a different level of excitement, seeing whales and dolphins and fur seals from the sky. It was a completely different perspective. And then filming basking sharks this year with them as well was absolutely incredible.
It's amazing to know a different point of view that you can do from the land, and you're so high up, and you can, like you say, years ago it was from the side of a helicopter. Do you want to talk a bit
Exactly.
about your first time in South Africa? Because obviously you've done a lot of work there. Do you want to talk to me a bit about that?
Absolutely, yeah. So South Africa has a special place in my heart now. So I went down initially for 2 months and I was working with a company called Marine Dynamics. So Marine Dynamics are a shark diving and a whale watching conservation company. So they'll use the shark cage diving and the whale watching tours basically for funding for conservation. So the main five species I would have worked with were your dolphin species, so your common and bottlenose, and then you had occasionally the critically endangered Indian Ocean humpback dolphin, which most people have never even heard of. So we had the dolphins, you had your whale species, your shark species, your fur seals, and the African penguin, which has now also been uplisted to critically endangered. So I was working with them as an intern, and I was either on the shark boats taking data for various sharks that would come up, your bronze whaler sharks, your seven gill sharks. And then on the whale watching boat, we would have had kind of, I was doing similar work. And that's really when the photography kicked off, because one of the massive uses of photography is for photo identification. So what most people don't realize is each whale, their markings, their fins, they're kind of like fingerprints. So if you get a photo of a humpback whale's tail fluke coming up through the water, each fin is different and it will have different spots. So you take a photo, you might only see the tail in person for a couple of seconds, but when you look at the photo, you can go back, run it through a software or a database or just through a printed catalog, and you can identify each individual whale. So
Really?
I was doing part of the photo identification with that, which was absolutely amazing to see. I mean, most people, when you're on a whale watching trip, you see a couple of whales come up and you don't think anything of it. And then the people that are looking at them regularly can look at one and say, oh, that one there is Beak or Valiant. I'm doing the same kind of thing here in Vancouver. And we're having whales come back from Mexico that the guides on board are getting excited about because they haven't seen them in months. So in South Africa, that's what I was doing. And then I was also working with the African Penguin and Seabird Sanctuary, which was kind of a rehabilitation center for seabirds and penguins that might get sick or injured, and then they'd be rehabilitated before releasing them back into the wild as well.
That must have been
So
very
two
good, wasn't
months. Oh, it was incredible. I mean, again, it was another one of these. I'd grown up watching these on TV and documentaries, and now suddenly I'm holding a penguin as somebody's giving it medication. So it was absolutely fantastic seeing all these amazing species that, I mean, I saw an albatross for the first time, which most people know is one of the biggest birds on the planet. And to see one in person was jaw-dropping.
mad.
Absolutely. Yeah, I still get excited about it. And then I returned last year, mainly to build up my portfolio in underwater photography. So I was diving in Shark Alley, which used to be home to the great whites before the killer whales started hunting them and kind of scared them out of the area. So I was diving in Shark Alley filming fur seals, and I was in an estuary as well. I was trying to film lesser guitar shark, which is it's a threatened species. It's like a mix between a shark and a ray. So it has a pointed snout. They're only about a meter long, but very little is known about them. So that was kind of my project, was to try and find them, which we did find in the end. So South Africa is an absolutely amazing place. A lot of friends down there now, and the conservation work they do down there, even just simple, if you want to call it simple, education work, as simple as telling somebody what something is and how it's being affected and how it's being threatened, that spreads message all around that world. I mean, if you have somebody coming from Spain, they mightn't have known any of this, and then suddenly they're going back to Spain and they're telling their friends and family about a massive issue that nobody else would know about. So learning about all the issues that they have down there, which aren't too dissimilar for issues we might have at home.
I love sharks. Like I, they're one of my favorite to just watching documentaries on them. But I think a lot of people when they hear of sharks, they think big vicious animals that just go for
Exactly.
a lot of swimming. But spending so much time around them, I'm sure you can advocate for it that they probably don't want to harm humans.
Sharks are very different to how you view them on TV when you have different programs kind of only highlighting the hunting skills. They don't highlight the fact that these animals, it's a curiosity. So when you see a shark approaching a human, they're quite shy animals and they are just investigating what you are. If you hear about a shark attack, it might be in murkier water or famously could be on a surfboard which resembles maybe one of their prey species. And a lot of the time they'll go and take a bite and kind of they're basically testing to see what you are. But I mean, I think there's on average about 10 shark attacks per year, and we're doing kind of the opposite. I think there's something like 250 million sharks killed per year. What I saw this year, which was absolutely amazing for the first time, were basking sharks. And I really just came to realize how shy these animals are, and they can be disturbed so easily. By having, say, too many boats around or too many people in the water with sharks, you can essentially change their behavior. So I think it's very important to give them their space. And obviously it's exciting seeing them up close, but I think a lot of respect has to be given to sharks, based on the fact that you have an idea of how they should act because you've seen it in TV, and in reality, a lot of them act completely differently.
Is there any other animals that you've seen underwater that I suppose they kind of blew you away?
Octopus.
Really?
Octopus are absolutely incredible. When I was down in South Africa last year, one of the projects we were doing was we were tagging cat sharks. So these cat sharks might only get to 1 meter in length. Most of them might be about 60 centimeters. So what we would do is we would enter the water with a bait canister, which was basically a plastic tube with holes drilled in it, and it had a wake in it, and we would fill it with sardines. So you're not feeding the animals, you're just attracting them in with the smell. And we would go down and carefully hand catch these sharks, bring them back to the beach, and we would tag them, measure them, photograph them, release them. But very quickly, in this little cove, we had an octopus that figured out if it saw the white bait canister, that meant food. And we would leave the bait canister in for, say, 5 minutes. And then when you would go in snorkeling afterwards to find what cat sharks were around, the bait canister would be gone. Very quickly, we figured out what was happening. And we'd have to go, and I have quite literally wrestled this bait canister off an octopus. The first time it happened and the octopus swam off, I thought, okay, well, that's obviously been scared off. And then every single day I would go back, the octopus would be there waiting for us to get in. And you could see it working it out. It would see us drop the bait canister down onto the sea floor, only a few meters below us. And then we'd kind of slowly hang back a bit to watch. And it would creep out tentacle by tentacle and kind of essentially tiptoe across the floor, grab the bait canister and run off with it back to its rock. And then it would try, you could see it opening. I've seen these on camera underwater where they will open the bait canister, take all the food out, and then swim off. They're incredibly intelligent. And you can see them working out problems like that. Even if we try to get closer, I mean, trying to photograph them can be quite difficult. I would try and get closer with the camera to try and get photos of it. And as soon as it would see me kind of inching closer, it would start creeping backwards, and eventually it would get to a stage where it would try and stay in its den, in its hole, and it would reach out one tentacle and try and kind of grab onto the bait canister and just slowly drag it back. But seeing them work out the problem as unscrewing the lid of something, it's incredible to see a wild animal suddenly figure that out with no experience of that, no instinct. It just figures out how to open a container like that. So they're massive problem solvers and they're incredible to watch doing anything.
Because now that you say it about the opening the top, I've seen it on TikTok. They opening like a jar or something. Somebody
Exactly, yeah.
just to show it, like it must be unreal. And I suppose away from the marine side of things and underwater in South Africa, obviously you've the wildlife and the tigers and lion, all the safari kind of side of things. Have you gone on any of safari trips over there for doing photos?
Haven't yet. That's still top of the bucket list now at the moment. I've definitely seen some of those animals anyway. I've gone to, there was a really, really good lion rehabilitation center where they'd have injured or sick lions and they'd kind of nurse them back and then release them. So seeing them up close, seeing an animal that size, and you really do get a size kind of perspective on just how big and how powerful they are. It's amazing to be in their presence. But big cats in general are fascinating animals to look at. I mean, like that, you can see thoughts moving around inside their head. So, I mean, we in Europe, for the most part, we only would have say lynx, which is kind of like a bobcat. It's a medium-sized cat, but seeing animals like a lion or a leopard now is it's very exciting. So I haven't yet done a safari, but it is absolutely top of my list now as well. So it'll happen eventually. I'm just not too sure when.
Because I watched this guy on YouTube, Forrest Gent or something his name
Oh, Forest Galante.
yeah, that's it.
Yes. Yeah.
He was at a rehabilitation center for tigers before, and like you say, seeing him up close, it's unreal. But going on a safari is definitely on my bucket list as well, because it's unbelievable seeing them up close. Like you say, you got a
Yeah.
disappointing round of photographer of the year, didn't you?
I did. So I've made it into the final round of Wildlife Photographer of the Year twice. I got in 2023 and 2024. 2023, the photo that got into the final round of that, which I think there's about 60,000 images entered into that. It's kind of, I suppose if you want to call it the Oscars of wildlife photography, for the most part, you're up against like National Geographic, BBC photographers, that kind of thing. And the final round is, it's the last step before they pick the final 100 photos. But the first photo that got into it was actually taken on the day that I first tested out the camera. I took it down in Wexford and it was of a spider crab sitting in kelp and seaweed on the bottom. And it was purely the day to test out the camera. I took this lovely photo of a spider crab completely camouflaged. It had algae growing all over it. And that made it into the final round. And then the following year, I had eight images make it into the final round, and seven of them were on the water. The eighth image, just going back to what we were saying about cameras, I took that in Malaysia on my cheap budget camera that I had just started out with in photography. I took that with me traveling in Asia, and I took a photo of smooth-coated otters stealing a fish from a fishing village. And that photo I took on a Nikon D5600, which again, budget camera, but you can
Just
do
goes
amazing
to
things
show
with these.
you don't need the big cameras to get the perfect picture. Did you enjoy down in Asia? That must have been good.
Loved it. It was completely different to anything I've ever experienced before. And I think that's why I enjoyed it so much. Thailand was amazing. Thailand is quite, it's very much a kind of holiday vacation destination. Vietnam was very special. Vietnam really feels like you're in a different world. The people there are so friendly, so lovely, so welcoming. And just getting to see different cultures and see how different it is from what you grew up with, what you knew, what you know. It's an amazing, I can't recommend traveling enough, but Asia was, again, completely different to what I'd ever seen before, and I think that's why I loved it so much.
Would it be more, like you say, completely different to the likes of South Africa? Would it be more kind of, would there be a lot of snakes and stuff over in the Asia side of the world?
There are, and unfortunately, I only saw one in the entire time I was
Really?
there. I was there in Asia for 3 months, and I was looking for snakes, deliberately looking for snakes, and I only managed to find one. But there are snakes over there. For the most part, snakes will avoid people. It was the same in South Africa. Snakes, generally speaking, don't want to be around people. And anytime you hear of somebody being bitten, it's because they were, say, out walking through brush, or they put their hand under something, and it's a defense mechanism essentially, where the snake doesn't know what you are, and it's kind of basically backing, or it's lashing out and saying, "Back off, I'm here, this is my little space." So for the most part, snakes, they don't want to be near people. There's no snakes that hunt people or deliberately follow people. They're quite kind of, they keep to themselves and they don't like to be disturbed. So snakes are generally fine once you kind of give them a bit of space, but they definitely have a couple of quite venomous snakes in Asia, but none more venomous than some of the ones in South Africa, like the Boomslang or the Black Mamba, which thankfully we didn't have where I was.
They're scary looking, the black mamba, when they open their mouth out.
Yeah, they are massive, massive snakes. I always kind of thought they would have been, I suppose, average snake size, maybe 1 meter or so, but they can get up to a couple of meters in length. They're quite big, but yeah, very, very venomous. But they're more in kind of the Eastern Cape, the hotter parts of South Africa. Where I was, we did have Boomslang, which I didn't see, but Boomslang, it in Afrikaans means tree snake. They are beautiful, beautiful animals. They have this bright emerald green color to them, and they blend in with the trees, but they're highly venomous.
Because it's over in the Everglades in America, where it's the pythons are kind of the invasive, aren't they?
Exactly, that's right. Yes, you get the, I mean, pythons were, I suppose, released into the wild. Basically, people that got them as pets, they got too big and then chucked them out. And now, because the climate is quite similar to where they're originally from, they're thriving, which it's a massive problem for native fauna down there. You have so many prey species that just cannot cope with a massive predatory snake like a python. So the pythons are a massive problem down there, but they are slowly kind of working to remove them. But once you introduce an invasive species, if it can thrive there, it's a massive problem. We do have similar problems in Ireland, but not on that kind of scale.
Is there anywhere around the world that you haven't been yet that it's on your bucket list? Any specific country or area?
Yeah, the Amazon is the big one.
Yeah.
That's the one now that I'm itching to see. And again, growing up watching David Attenborough documentaries on the Amazon and South America in general, the Amazon is kind of, in my eyes, that's the pinnacle of wilderness and nature. So that's somewhere now that I am dying to go and see. So as far and remote as possible, that's where I want to try and get, ideally with the camera in hand. But even if I just get to see it in person, I'll be quite happy with that. But the Amazon is, it's one of the most biodiverse, if not the most biodiverse places on the planet.
Is there anywhere where you ever were, and Daniel, and you saw something that you would always have gone for a picture but didn't have your camera, and you were kind of sad you didn't have it to get the picture of it?
There probably is. I'm trying to think now of various species that I would have seen that I didn't have the camera for. There's always, it's usually a bird of prey that flies past and I don't have a camera. But every now and again, I mean, if I'm out and I haven't seen wildlife, say I'm out in Dunsany Nature Reserve and I haven't seen wildlife for a few hours, I'll put the camera back into my bag because I know well I will see wildlife as soon as I don't have the camera. So it's kind of, it's just how it works. But I suppose the main one now that I would love to get really good photographs of, I've yet to see a wolf now, but I've talked to a few people and they've all said it's usually when you're not expecting a wolf up here in British Columbia, usually further north in British Columbia or on Vancouver Island, the sea wolves. It's usually when you're not expecting it that a wolf will appear and you don't have the camera. So a wolf now would be way up there on the list. That's something now that I would absolutely love to photograph.
Would you ever like to go on the, I suppose, the other side, to kind of polar, to like polar bears and the kind of Antarctic
Yeah,
side of things?
absolutely. Yeah, I've got a friend, Felix. He just won He had a photo that won, I think it was the wildlife category for National Geographic Travel Photographer of the Year. And he works on expeditions up to, I think, Svalbard in the Antarctic or in the Arctic. And I mean, seeing a polar bear up close, I can't even imagine how spectacular that would be. Because I was on a hike the other day and I had a black bear. He kind of
Really?
followed me along the trail for a while, which was terrifying at the start. He hopped out of a bush about 3 meters away from me, but he was very relaxed, very chill, but still, in my eyes, a big animal. Grizzlies are twice the size and polar bears are bigger again. So seeing a polar bear up close would just be unbelievable. And then on in the Antarctic, seeing emperor penguins would be, I can't imagine what that must be like now, seeing a penguin on the Antarctic. I've seen penguins obviously in South Africa, but I think seeing an emperor penguin, seeing them for years on David Attenborough's documentaries, I think seeing one of them would be pretty special as well. So I'm absolutely up for the colder climates as well.
And last one before we finish up, you mentioned there Vietnam and stuff. Does it still blow you away any country that you're in? The I suppose I always ask people that I interview that do traveling and things like that. Does it blow you away how many Irish people are around the world?
It doesn't matter where you go, you'll meet somebody Irish. My first day in South Africa in with Marine Dynamics, I was sitting in a room, basically the kind of your first day as an intern, they say, right, we're going to put you on the boat as just a normal passenger and you can see how things work. And the first people who sit down beside me are a group of Irish teachers.
What are the
So, I
odds?
mean, even in Vietnam, I was up with three other Irish. We were singing the Fields of Athenry karaoke, and there was this one girl who was recording us, and I was like, oh, she must have family in Ireland, and turns out she was in school with my cousin in Cork.
It's
So
mad.
you Irish everywhere. I mean, it's a lovely community and everyone always gets on well as soon as you realize, oh, you're Irish too. But I don't think I've gone to a single country that I haven't met an Irish person before.
Just goes to show, doesn't it? Where can
Does
people get your work online if they want to have a look, Daniel?
So the main thing that I post on is Instagram, DF Wild, but I have a website which is dfwild.com. Otherwise you can just look up Daniel Files Photography and it will usually pop up. But DF Wild is kind of my handle for everything. So Instagram and TikTok would be DF Wild, or my website is dfwild.com for, I suppose, photo prints or any other inquiries as well.
Daniel, you're a gent. All the best over in Vancouver, and thanks so much for your time today. Now, unfortunately, that's all we have time tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I appreciate you tuning in as always. Stay tuned in here to Radio Kerry because Brian Priestley is up next with That's Jazz. I'll be back at the same time next week from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
You're listening to Standout with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.